Hello and welcome to episode 58 of Tabletop Game Talk, a show where we talk about tabletop games of all types. I'm one of your hosts, Josh.
I'm Chris.
And I'm Kitty.
Today we're talking about classic mainstream games, Monopoly, Clue, Risk, Life, Scrabble, Trivial Pursuit, Yahtzee. Everyone's heard of them. Most have played them. How do these games affect the hobby today? We'll talk about it. But first, a huge thank you to our Patreon friends of the show, Emil Giljam, George Gia, and Adam Harrison. And a thank you to our newest Patreon, Nick Quickstra. And also a huge thank you to all of our other patrons as well.
Thank you, Josh. Thank you. This episode, I went back and forth on titles.
Yeah.
If you're paying attention last episode, this was a last minute type in at the end of the show notes. Classic games. It turns out there's a lot of classic games out there. So we're turning this into a series. Not consecutive. Don't worry. You're not going to listen to classic games.
Were there going to be cliffhangers at the end of each episode?
Ooh, maybe. Hints as to,
no. Probably not.
He's like, no, we're not doing that. So this is where I was kind of thinking we were going in the first place, talking about kind of mainstream games. Like the games that Josh was talking about, but we're going to have future ones. There's a few games that I really wanted to talk about, like chess, checkers, backgammon apparently is 5,000 years old.
Maybe Mahjong.
Go. Go, Makala. All of these games I'm dubbing ancient games. So they're definitely classics. They've been around for, as long as this country's games. Been around. Yeah. So we'll talk about those another time. And then I also wanted to do an episode on like just 52 card games. Like,
games you play with a poker deck.
Games you play with a poker deck. And we might actually do an episode just on poker. So there was so much to go, we had to focus. So today we're doing mainstream. That's just kind of my, I've changed the title three times on Board Game Geeks for this show. So actually, technically, I only changed the title twice. I got the wrong episode number in the first time. But anyway, Massive Darkness. I'm a master of segues. I just, jump right into where we're going. Contest is still going on. This is the 26th as you're listening to this. So you have 3 days to enter. It's Friday the 29th. That's your last day to enter. We will announce on the next episode who wins Massive Darkness. This is a Kickstarter version of Massive Darkness, which includes all of the Kickstarter exclusives that came along with the base pledge. I believe it's a Lightbringer pledge if you're checking to see what's there. If you're international, you will have to cover shipping. I'm guessing that's going to be around $200. So
it's not as heavy as Gloomhaven. But it's close.
It's big, the dimensions, the weight. Yeah. I don't have the same hookups that Cool Mini or Not has. So it might be cheaper for you just to order directly. Let's see. And all you have to do to enter is email us at tabletopgametalk.com at gmail. Email us at tabletopgametalk@gmail.com with the subject September giveaway. Also, new requirement. Put your actual name in the email if your email address is something like x23578 at some random place.com. Or just let me know your name.
I want to get an email address from some random place.com.
I'm going to actually register that if it doesn't exist. It has to exist.
It's got to.
Yeah. We'll fact check that in a little bit. So, yes. Oh, we're starting off strong today. 3 days to go. Enter as soon as you can if you want to be in that contest, and we'll announce next week. Gamehole Con, first weekend of November. I keep saying first weekend of November. I should probably actually say the dates.
The dates are going to be looked up. It is November 3rd through the 5th.
Right. So 3rd is the Thursday, right?
3rd is the Friday. So the 2nd?
2nd. Yeah. So I think it starts on it's a half day Thursday.
Yes.
And then Friday, Saturday, Sunday. We will be there and hosting games on Friday and Saturday and Sunday. Friday, we're still looking for some help, especially around the 2:00 on Friday area. We had a few people that want to be there but can't. So if you are going to be there and you want to help out for a couple hours on Friday, let me know. And all you have to do is either teach Scythe or a different...
Sheriff of Nottingham.
Yeah. So that's what we're looking for. That is our next convention. Oh, Kickstarters.
Oh, Kickstarters.
So I'm going to start with the games first because I did something that I didn't think I was going to do. So we'll get to that in a second. The first Kickstarter I did was The Networks. This is the Executives. So The Networks : Executives. It's an expansion to the game called The Networks, which I have not owned but want to own. It's a game designed by Gil Hova. It is about running kind of like a struggling startup TV station.
I've actually played that one.
Have you really?
Yeah, one of the cons we went to, I played a little demo and I enjoyed myself.
Well, I have heard nothing but good things, and I've met Gil a couple times, and he's a really cool guy. So Wordzy actually was when I met him.
Oh, great.
And yeah. Which is another cool game. So this is a Kickstarter for the expansion to that, and because it's an expansion, you can also chip in and get the base game as well. So that's what I did here. The expansion's only $29 if you already have the base game. If you want the base game, the expansion, and some extra exclusives on top of that, I think the high-end pledge is $80. It just gives you everything. I won't tell you what I did. But you only have 2 days left to back this one if it sounds interesting. You haven't played The Networks, but you know that kind of you've heard good things about it. Give it a try. I think it's hard to describe. Maybe Josh, you describe it.
It's been about a year.
On the spot.
Yeah, I seem to remember from the little I do remember, you had like show cards, and you would then try and attract maybe I think talent to that, and then that would kind of like add up your score that way. And beyond that, I forget. But it's cool. It was a cool.
Yeah, game. Get ratings to get money, so you could get more shows to better shows from better, probably better writers or producers or something that would attract better talent. I think the executive expansion adds like more, like now you get executives to come to your TV station and help run things and stuff like that.
Gotcha.
So it's doing really well for Gil. I think he actually, once this game hit, he became a game designer full time. So congratulations on that side. The other one I backed was Wanderer, The Cult of Barnacle Bay. Because we talked about this on last episode. I just got in the fact I should look at it, and I knew I was going to back it, and I ended up backing it like a day or so later. We just watched the video for this one on Kickstarter.
It's a fun video.
It's a very fun video.
I would say at the very...
high production quality.
Yeah. I would say at the very least, you should watch the video on this. The premise is a nice town run with, you know, normal, cute, humanoid animals, and then some evil thing from the sea attacks a town and turns them into half cute animal, half evil fish-like animal.
There's like fish bats and crab arm
and shark bears.
Something shark bears, tentacle rabbits.
Oh, the tentacle rabbits. So, and you are one of five heroes. You have squirrels and goats and
goat
red
wizards.
red pandas
and it's a co-op. And you're trying to... A co-op campaign, choose your own adventure, is how they're dubbing this.
Yes.
Well, they had classes as well. It was like wizards and soldiers and thieves. And
yeah, the squirrel is a thief. That makes sense. Yeah. But Kitty said the ears are too pointy.
I did.
Yeah.
I don't know any squirrels with pointy ears. Oh,
it's probably the red squirrel from the UK. They have very pointy ears.
Oh, do they?
I'll pull up an image later and have a look.
All right. All right. Well, I backed it.
Despite its squirrel ear... discrepancies.
Despite the squirrels, that yes, but I like squirrels and they're cute. This one is running for about another week, and it is just a single. Well, I guess there's two pledge levels, but there's really only one pledge level. This one's $90, and you get everything. There's a ton of miniatures involved. It seems to be there's a few Kickstarter exclusives. It looks like there's some expansion heroes. There's a King Ross who's a lion, and then Bebo who maybe is a cat. Has a little pet as well.
Whoa, those are really pointy ears on a squirrel.
Told you.
So Josh just showed us a picture of this.
A red squirrel.
European red squirrel, which looks exactly like the squirrel in the game.
They're endangered, actually. The gray ones are like forcing them out and taking their habits. They're more aggressive. Bless the little red squirrel.
Not nice. So anyway, yes. Wanderer, The Cult of Barnacle Bay. This one looks pretty cool.
Yeah, something cool we didn't mention about it, flippable tiles. You can go underground with that. That's really neat.
Yeah, so you're in the city, and then all of a sudden you like go through an entrance that into the suburbs, then you suburbs into these subterranean area.
That sounds better. I think go to the suburbs.
And you flip the tile over, and then you're like
you're
underground.
You're in a Target parking lot, and you can't find a parking spot.
suburbia. You just drive around for hours trying to find the closest spot. no offense to people who do that, but just saying.
You're moving to the suburbs, so you're allowed to make fun of it now.
Well, it's funny because I grew up in the suburbs, and that's what you would do. You just drive around looking for the closest spot. But now since I've been in the city, like, I'll walk a mile and a half to go get a, you know, bottle of, I don't know, well, beer or something. I don't know. But it's just like walking's like no big deal. So now when I park in a parking lot, I'm like, oh, I'm just going to find the furthest spot out and I'll just walk in. It's not that big a deal.
That's true.
I'll get over that very quickly once I move though. Okay. So was it two episodes ago? We talked about gaming tables? Or was it last episode? No, it was two episodes. Two episodes ago, we talked about gaming tables. And I think I came to the conclusion that I just didn't want to spend all this money on gaming tables. And then...
Oh, Chris.
I was on Board Game Geek.
Oh, Chris.
And there was an ad for the Table of Ultimate Gaming on Kickstarter. So I went to the Table of Ultimate Gaming on Kickstarter by clicking on the ad, which actually made me... Now there's a Tabletop Game Talk ad on Board Game Geek. I'm like, wow, these things are really effective. I should put one of these out there. So if you see our ad or you're here because you saw our ad, let me know. I'd love to know if that's actually effective. So the Table of Ultimate Gaming... they're running a campaign now. It's a 35-day campaign. I came into it a little late, so there's only probably 48 hours left as you're hearing this to back it, but I definitely backed it.
How much? Come on.
Well, first let me describe what it is.
Okay.
So it's just a table.
Okay.
They don't claim that this is meant to be like, they're like, we're not a furniture company. We make tables for gaming. Like, that's what they want to do. And it has the leaves, like we were talking about. It's not the single slab. But what they do with the leaves is you can put them in the side of the table, and you can pull them halfway out, and they become desk, like desktops next to you. So these things are multifunctional leaves. Josh is looking at me confused, which
leaves.
Means...
Yeah, I don't know what you mean by leaves.
Inserts. What's the other
like
term?
Like the boards that you put
like
on.
Like the tabletop thing.
Oh,
like
I see. That turns it into a table.
Yeah, turns it into a flat table.
Instead of having the well.
Correct.
Right.
Yep. And I talked about the well, how I don't like the 3-inch well. Well, this has 3-inch or 1-inch. You can change it.
Oh.
So I can have my less, you know, I don't have to have a deep well. It has little decorative tiles that fit on around the side of the tables and on the table legs that can decorate it in any kind of different way. So they're like magnetic tiles. And you can pull them off and you can change them. So if I'm running D&D, I can put my dragon tiles all over it. If I'm running games, I can put the meeple tiles on it.
Where do you buy these tiles from?
From the same company.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, but they're not actually crazy expensive.
Okay.
They have cup holders. And the cup holders, there's a rail system. It's relatively common. But the cup holders go into the rail. I want to say it's about 3 inches deep. So they look nice and sturdy. The cup holders also have a little pad on there, so you can put little pieces and dice on there. And they have a little cutout so that you can put mugs in there or wine glasses. Really well thought out cup holders.
That's true.
There's a DM. These are extras. You can get like a DM screen. You can get player boards. I did pick up some player boards. There's three different wood colors. So there's like the natural with the white top, and then it's like a dark with a black top and like a brown. So the white is going to go really well in the game room. And I'm like, I have to have this. It's only $1,000.
I guess that's not too bad. It's still more expensive than some of the poker tables I saw. I agree.
It is definitely more expensive than some of the poker
but
tables.
But I guess it's more functional.
This has a picture of dudes standing on it, though. Which I would not stand on any of those poker tables
you're
looking at.
Yeah.
It looks more sturdy.
So you're saying I can dance on your gaming table. What you're telling me.
They are standing, not dancing. But... you want to spend another $1,000, we'll get one that you can dance on.
You're saying it's sturdy enough that you don't mind me dancing on it. Well, but why would you ever want to dance on it?
I don't want
to
dance on the table. No dancing on the table. But yeah, this is the most expensive thing I ever bought on Kickstarter. I still think it's a fraction of the price of what I was looking at for things of equal value.
I'll give you that.
So Table of Ultimate Gaming is what it's called. Lots and lots of pictures. I actually did run by this, maybe didn't run, but walked by it at Gen Con. And it didn't really draw my attention that much because Gen Con had like 8 or 9 different booths for tables.
There was also so much going on at Gen Con.
Yeah, so I didn't like go close up to it, but I did look at it. I'm like, oh yeah, that's interesting. That's cool. It's like just another gaming table, and then walked off because I just stopped looking at prices. The prices on all these things were so crazy expensive. I'm just like, all right, yes, it's expensive. The value here, though, is crazy. I don't get it paid anything for this. I just, you know. And the $1,000 is actually the highest end table. It's the largest table.
Oh, you can get cheaper ones from these guys?
Yeah, the initial, the cheapest one you can get is $500.
Okay.
And that's $500. Bad. That one's a 2x4. So 2 feet by 4 feet. If you want a 3 feet by 5 feet, it's 600. And if you want a 4 foot by 6 foot, it's 750. That's the one I got, but then I added all of the different accessories on it on top of that, which bumps the price up a little bit more.
Gotcha.
So, and apparently they're going to start fulfilling in January.
There we go.
So fingers crossed.
So we'll see which comes first, your gaming table or my baby.
Yeah, it's a race. Dun, 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 dun. I'm going to actually email these guys and say, hey, look, I have a bet. Can you get this out to me before the baby? Just that's all I'm asking. So anyway, that it was my Kickstarter update. Let's go to feedback, Josh.
Indeed. Let's get some feedback about past episodes. And if you have feedback about this or any of our previous episodes, email us or go to our Board Game Geek forums, easily found at tabletopgametalk.com/BGG. And the first one is from Christy. She says, loved the BSG recap. I love it when games give you such an epic narrative experience that everybody remembers a bunch of details later. Those are my favorite kind of gaming memories. Cool. One thing that was touched on briefly but was not really explored is people's comfort level playing hidden role games. Not everyone enjoys or feels comfortable doing that. Here I'm thinking especially of new gamers. People with social anxiety, introverts, etc. Maybe you don't enjoy trying to lie, like in Sheriff of Nottingham, for example. I don't really enjoy Coop, The Resistance, Spyfall, etc. They feel stressful to me, and I especially hate being one of the bad people or feeling like I have something to hide. That's very true.
Yeah. Well, and Coup versus Coup.
Oh, yeah.
I do the same thing, though. Yeah. So Coup is a game where you have two cards, and you get to do they're face down. You get to do something based on what the card is, but you can bluff about what those cards are, and someone can call you on it. And if you don't show the card that you of the action you just use, then you lose one of those cards. When you lose both cards, you're out. Very much a deception thing. The Resistance, I think we've talked about enough. Spyfall, everyone gets a card that shows a picture of a location except for one person who gets a thing that says spy. So you don't know any information. And then the group starts asking each other questions to try to figure out who doesn't know where you really are. So those types of games, I agree, can be really stressing.
I mean, it can be stressful even if you're not the person, but then all the other good people are convinced you are. Like, that happened to me.
That did happen to you in Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah. So I get it. I definitely find it tough being the bad guy too. So I do understand that.
I think the reason it didn't get brought up as much in the episode is because we realized as we were recording, I was never the traitor, and I'm totally the person who gets freaked out by being the traitor. So just by luck of the draw, you know, we didn't have that conversation a little bit.
And I'm kind of interested to play a hidden traitor game with you where you actually do become the traitor, because we will start accusing you. And
I know.
You're not very good at being accused.
I feel like I'm making my I'm not the bad guy face right now, even.
Well, then Christy goes on and mentions Insider, which is essentially 20 questions. That's one where you're trying to throw the rest of the group off. But actually, that's not really what Insider is. Insider is where you're trying to get the group to
get the answer.
Get the answer.
Werewords is where you're trying to throw
Werewords is the opposite.
Yeah.
So Insider, I think, is kind of a reverse on that. We always talked about Insider as being... Wait, how does Insider work? Now, Christy has me questioning.
The insider knows the answer, and they're trying to get everyone to it without being found out.
Yeah. Right.
And then everyone has a vote straight after it finishes as to whether who they think the insider is.
Right. But the insider is working with the group,
but
not so hard that it makes people think. Because then the insider will win if you don't guess who the insider is.
That's right.
And then everyone else loses. So even though you worked with them the entire time, now people are like, I think, Josh, you were more helpful than everyone else.
Yeah.
Which just sounds like a way nicer way to accuse people.
Yeah.
Werewords, though, it is, you have two roles. The werewolf knows the word and is working against the group. They don't want the word guessed. And the seer knows the word and is trying to help it along without being found out. Yep.
So, and if the werewolf is trying to throw you off, and then if you don't get the right answer, if you can guess who the werewolf is, you'll still win. If you do get the right answer and the werewolf can guess who the seer is, you'll still lose. So I think Werewords is a little bit more of a, it's a little bit more hidden traitor, and there's a number of levels on it, which make it both a bit more interesting and a bit more gamer-esque. Honestly, I think I like Insider better.
Me too, so far.
It's so easy, and nobody feels bad for being the Insider.
It needs an app, though.
It does need an app. You could use the Werewords app for Insider, and you'd be fine. All right, Nick.
So I have just discovered your podcast, and I'm really enjoying it. I'm relatively new to this type of gaming. I was wondering if you have ever done Kickstarter advice as a topic. As I was thinking of backing a couple of games, I played at Grand Con in my hometown, Grand Rapids, Michigan. The Soundbound Saga?
Yep.
Soundbound?
Sagebound? Sagabound. Wait a minute.
You typed this.
I think it's
wrong.
Stonebound. Yes. I just copied and pasted.
Stonebound. That's a real word. Thanks a lot, Chris. And Legends of Draxa were both really fun. Thanks for what you do on the podcast. I'll definitely be a regular listener.
Thanks, Nick. I think I'm wondering, I don't know, either Samia walking around with a t-shirt on or grabbed one of the cards, or maybe just coincidentally completely found us on a thing spot. Welcome, Nick. Thank you for being a patron. He listened to a first show and decided to patron us, and that is my favorite kind of listener. yes, we have done a Kickstarter episode in the past. Kitty is looking at the number right now. It was kind of early on. I'm thinking of doing another one, though, at some point in the near future. Obviously, we do Kickstarters at the beginning of every episode. These are just Kickstarters that I choose to back, and every once in a while, I'll point out other games that people kind of, you know, throw my way as something that, like, kind of heads up, hey, this has been mentioned. There's a couple out on Board and Game Geek on our forums right now that I haven't looked deep into, but I will, and we'll let you guys know about them on next week. My advice for Kickstarter is always the same. You know, see how people are talking about it on Board Game Geek, and if it looks like something that people are interested in, you're probably fairly safe. I have yet to have any super bad experience with a Kickstarter game.
To be fair, you're not great at following up on whether or not they have shipped, and if they are on time, you just kind of let it be a surprise and come to you as they will.
That is true.
And plus, I feel like your knowledge of the gaming industry helps you a bit more than just like a medium level gamer.
I don't know if it's my knowledge or my willingness to spend money on something that I know nothing about.
Okay. Maybe that's true. Yeah.
If you are interested in Kickstarter, you can friend Chris on Facebook, and then you can follow him on Kickstarter, and you can see even more of his activity than we discuss on the show as well.
So you'll know immediately. It's like, oh, they must be recording because Chris just backed two things, which is usually what happens. It's like, oh, I haven't backed anything this week. We're going to record in a few hours. What
Better
do I want?
Go check.
Oh my God. We're forcing his habit to go into overdrive.
It's so true. Although the game table was completely organic. I was just on Board Game Geek. I clicked on a link and said, oh, I must have this.
I've let it go now. I've accepted that you've bought this insanely extravagant purchase.
I recently saw a post from Reddit that's been going around about somebody who decided that they would not be kickstarting games anymore and kind of their reasoning why. And I had a couple people email me like, oh, I hope it's not Chris. I was like, no, it will never be Chris.
I'll keep backing him. I think that to Kitty's point where I'm not really tracking, that is a kind of a key to Kickstarter. Back it and just be surprised when it shows up. Don't be like, oh, well, you said it was going to be in August of 2018 and now it's, you know, January of 2019. That's going to happen. A lot of these Kickstarters are done by people who have never gone through the process of getting something printed and shipped from China and, you know, basically production windows and things like that.
There will be delays.
There will be delays. So
you'll still be one of the first people to get the game, though.
You will.
You're not going to, like, kickstart a game and then, you know, not have it ship and then see it in Target later. That's
exception would be sort of like, you know, Cool Mini a Lot and Eric Lang and people like that who have been there and done that.
Yes.
And those people probably are going to ship roughly on time.
Honestly, if you back a Kickstarter that's backed by a company, and a lot of companies do that, you're safe. You're good. And they know what they're doing. So you're probably going to get it pretty close to the window that they're estimating.
The more independent and the newer the designer is, usually the more likely there are to be delays, but those can also be some of the best surprisingly great games that you didn't see coming.
Yeah, Gloomhaven, when it first went to Kickstarter, it somewhere between 350 to 400,000 is what they raised. It's now, I believe, the number four game on BoardGameGeek and only going to go up once the rest of the games ship. Its second Kickstarter did 4 million. You know, and the people who got that from the original Kickstarter and original pre-order were not disappointed. Now, that's obviously the exception. Not every game does that. But, you know, it's kind of up to you to decide what's the risk reward. How much do I want to invest in a game now so that I can see it, you know, several months, if not a year or plus down the road?
And if you're enjoying this conversation, you should go back and listen to episode 31 about Kickstarter.
Wow, that was a long time ago.
It was a long time ago.
All right. And since you're probably not enjoying this conversation because we're not talking about our topic, we are going to go on topic now. We were going to do a game of the day. I will just mention, honorable mention,
Herbaceous.
Herbaceous.
You don't say the H.
All right.
Unless you're me.
Herbaceous.
Unless you're British. And then you can get away with it.
H-E-R-B-A-C-E-O-U-S. This is a push your luck 1 to 4 player game where you're planting herb gardens. It's really, really cool. Check it out. We'll talk about it again later, maybe. No promises. First of all, I'm going to hit this button so we can actually get on topic.
In this episode, we're talking about mainstream games. Games everyone has heard of and what people tend to think of when you say, like board games. Is this a good thing or does it hide the depth of the hobby? We'll try to do our best to come up with some kind of answer to that.
I may have left out a word there.
It's fine.
Basically, what I was getting at is these are the kind of games where when I go to someone and say, or they ask me, it's like, oh, what do you like to do? I'm like, well, I play a lot of board games. Oh, so you like Monopoly or Clue? Actually, Monopoly is usually the big one. But sometimes I'd be like, sort of. And then someone might say, oh, I really liked Clue or I really liked Risk or Yahtzee. Well, most people don't say Yahtzee, but everyone knows it.
Everybody knows
Yahtzee. Everybody knows it. So we put a list of games together. This is not complete, but I'm just going to list a few of them. We said them at the top of the show. Monopoly, Clue, Risk, Life, Scrabble, Trivial Pursuit, Yahtzee. We keep talking about Sorry.
Did anyone ever play Mousetrap?
Mousetrap. Yes. Right. Yep. So these are games where I think even if you haven't played them, you feel like you know them.
Yes.
And that's why I'm calling them mainstream games. This is a definition I've completely made up. This is something, all I'm saying when I say this is a game that most people have heard of.
Can I, because to that point, I actually have never played Mousetrap, but I feel like I know it. It was one of those ones that it looks so cool. It's like one of those Rube Goldberg machines where you kind of hit one thing and it all goes off. And I always wanted to play it. I mean, do you guys play it? Was it any good?
It's so disappointing.
Oh, man, it looks so cool on the advertisements.
It never works the way it's supposed to. Something always goes awry and you get like 3 steps into the thing and it's like, now it's doing nothing.
It's stopped.
Yeah. Well, and I don't think most people have ever played it as a game. You're normally just trying to build the contraption.
Oh, okay.
But there is an actual game to it. I think you're trying to get certain parts and you're trying to be the first person to complete the path.
The only time I played it, I was in college and we'd had a few beverages.
Yeah.
So probably why you couldn't get it to work.
Yeah.
No, we treated it as kids. We couldn't get it to work. I think as adults, drunk college students did a better job than children putting it together, but I'm not sure we actually did a good job.
Right.
Yeah. So I don't know.
And you probably weren't playing it as a game.
We did play. We played by the rules in college.
Oh, nice.
I don't know if you've met me.
I was going to say, you insisted on it, didn't you? That's what happened. Even when you were drunk. We're playing by the rules.
This is how this works. Well, I'm trying to decide, or kind of just want to talk it through, whether or not this is good or bad. When I go to someone and I'm like, oh, I like board games, and they say, you know, they give me a typical mainstream game, and then I say, well, have you ever heard of like Settlers of Catan or Ticket to Ride? I'm kind of deflecting from mainstream games into mass market games. Again, a loose definition, don't call me on it. But these are games that are in, you know, every Target, Walmart, you can find them anywhere, but a little bit more modern. And sometimes I get blank stares and sometimes like, oh yeah, I think I played that with my cousin once at a Thanksgiving or something.
Yeah.
So is this bad or good? Like, I don't know.
Is Warpbag the fact that you're trying to deflect them onto those games?
No, the fact that people are just jump to mainstream games as what a board game is.
Well, I mean, you know, it depends on your perspective, really. I mean, you know, I look through the threads and everyone's like really bashing these types of games. I mean, understandably, in a way, a lot of them, you know, their game mechanics aren't very developed, as you would say, if you were, you know, really into board games, which most people listening are. But, you know, they at least, as most people did point out, led you as an intro into the world of gaming. They introduce you to some mechanics that are sort of basic to a lot of games. I don't know, I had great memories of these games, so I don't think they're bad in that sense. You know, a lot of kids, you know, you have all these wonderful family memories tied to them.
I think these games lead people further into the games. If they're enjoying these games and they're going to Target and they've played all the games they can find at their Target, you know, that's when they start looking for, like, what else is out there and exploring that. And I think they're really good jumping off points if you're trying to introduce someone to a new game. Be like, so what's the game that you like? Do you like Clue? Do you like Monopoly? Do you like Yahtzee? What is it that you like to play? I have something that's going to use a mechanic like that. You're going to feel like it's a little bit familiar, but it's going to be way more fun.
Yeah.
And I think they're really good diving boards into the hobby.
So what if they're not really looking to learn new games? They're just kind of looking to learn about what your hobby is. So like I say, when I say I'm into board games and they say, oh, you know, like Monopoly, I try to defend it. I'm like, well, yeah, sort of, but
don't
better.
Judge us by these games. Right. Is essentially what you're saying.
Exactly. So that's where my it's not really a frustration. It's just like, all right, now I feel like I'm on the defensive. Right. I'm like, no, not like Monopoly. Monopoly is a fine game. I grew up on Monopoly. I played Monopoly like, I don't know, something like 60 times one summer. Like, I really, really enjoyed that game. And it was two-player Monopoly. And I got my butt kicked every single time. But I really liked it. So I know those memories, but most people see those kinds of games as things you play at the holidays and you don't pull them out as like a Friday night activity.
I mean, in a way, they're correct. They are board games. I think the defensiveness comes out because it's like to, you know, a seasoned person like yourself, it's like, well, yeah, but those are badly done versions of this thing I love. You know, it's like you've come along, and someone said this in the threads, you know, the analogy that they made was like daytime TV. It's like, well, there's lots of TV programs out there. And if you judge them all by daytime TV, then okay, yeah, then TV's terrible. But there's some really great TV shows. You just have to, you know what you're looking for and know the really well-directed, acted ones, as opposed to just thinking that every TV show is like Days of Our Lives or whatever it is.
Don't bash Days of Our Lives. Josh,
I've never even seen it.
Stay-at-home moms unite against that.
Well, that's a great analogy. I've never even seen it, yet you know it. That is exactly what we're talking about when we talk about these mainstream games.
Right.
I don't know. I always like to use it as a moment to educate, because I don't think they're coming from a place of, like, disdain or, like, they're trying to talk down to us. I think to people in the hobby, it does come across like that sometimes, though, because these games are often very simple. And I think this was also on Board Game Geek. Sonny pointed out Monopoly is older than the movie Gone with the Wind.
Yeah.
It's an old game, and everyone knows it because it's been around forever. And it might not be the best representative of a board game, but that's what people know. And they're not saying, like, oh, you like Monopoly? They're saying, like, oh, like Monopoly. Yeah. They're saying it with, like, oh, I know a thing that, you know, they're looking for a commonality. So I like to, like, jump off from there and use it as a, like, oh, yeah, but I also like these other ones. And there's conventions about them. There's new ones coming out all the time. And check out your local gaming store. Maybe I'm just, like. Yeah.
Well, I also liked that, you know, you look at old movies and you look at modern movies. And a lot of people will say, oh, the old movies were classics. And you got to watch, you know, Gone with the Wind or Citizen Kane or, you know, those types of movies.
I don't like Gone with the Wind, though.
Yeah. When it's I look at the movie. Yeah, when I look at it, I'm just like, I watched this really cool movie and with modern
direction and cinematography and everything that's come since. Yeah,
exactly. So I think that's sort of where you come with board games as well. Now, Monopoly, we keep using it as an example, but it honestly is an exception to every single rule.
True.
It is a game, and I told Josh and Kitty I was going to do this, so I'm going to do this. I'm going to tell you how to play Monopoly right now. Monopoly is a game where you're going to choose a token. And the token has nothing to do with really anything. So it could be a thimble, a dog, a car, a wheelbarrow. Why not be a wheelbarrow?
Top hat.
Top hat. To be the iron.
Iron. These are symbols. These are just tokens you're going to put, and everyone starts on go. You are going to roll two dice, and you're going to move that many spaces on the board. If you land on a property, you have the option of buying that property. So you spend a certain amount of money, you gain that property. If you don't want to buy the property, most people will just leave the deed in the bank. Doesn't happen. However, by the rules, you should auction that property where everyone gets to bid, and you just keep going around and bidding from $1 on up until somebody says, this is the high bid, and everyone else passes. Then that person gets that property.
Is somebody an auctioneer?
No, I believe it goes to the person to the left. Actually, no, The person who landed gets to bid first. Then the person to that person can left goes, and you just keep going around.
Oh, house rules. There should be an auctioneer. That sounds great.
There could be an auctioneer.
Yeah. I think there should just be like an auctioneer banker role, because I want to practice talking. $1, $2, $2, $3.
So, or you may land on something that gives you an event card. And those event cards will give you money or cost you something, or something will happen.
Send you to jail.
If you roll doubles, you get to take your turn and take another turn.
Love that.
And if you roll doubles again, you get to take another turn. Ugh. And if you roll doubles again, you don't get to take another turn. You go directly to jail.
Oh.
Three doubles in a row, you go to jail. Yeah. There's one spot on the board that does nothing for you. Well, one that does nothing, which is free parking. When you land there, you do nothing.
But what about all the money that everyone puts on it?
Oh, right. You could put money on free parking. But what that would do is keep putting money into the economy, keeping the game going forever.
Oh.
It's not in the rules.
It's not in the rules.
Yeah.
When you're just visiting jail, that kind of is a non-spot. And honestly, go is sort of a non-spot too, because passing go gives you the same effect as landing on go.
House rules, we always said double if you land on it.
Double if you land. Oh, yeah. See?
Monopoly is so house ruled.
Yep.
Yeah.
Everywhere you go.
If you have all of a particular color of properties, which is usually three properties in a particular color, except for the two cheapest and the two most expensive, those are two properties in that color, then you can start putting houses and hotels on them.
You have a monopoly.
If someone lands on a property you own, they pay you rent.
Based on how much you own and how many properties you have on it, all that kind of stuff.
How many houses and how many... They do not have the option of not paying you rent. Again, another rule that's often overlooked. They must pay you rent and mortgage all of their properties up until they've given you everything.
So wait, the reason for you boring everyone with the rules of Monopoly is to point out all of the things that no one ever plays by, even though they're the rules.
I'm doing a little of both. I just think we always talk about how to play like modern games. I just want to see if I could do it for Monopoly.
Right.
Is my family mean that we've always enforced the you must pay rent rule?
So I think a lot of times I've seen the case where it's like, okay, well, you don't have to pay me rent because you'd go bankrupt, but you have to give me free passage on the next two times I land on your properties.
Ooh, or I don't think like we ever played that either.
Which non-binding contracts, not allowed to do that. It's against the rules.
My family said, F you, you're bankrupt.
But wait, hang on. What about, couldn't you sell if you had hotels and houses? I thought you could sell.
You can keep selling everything, but you must keep selling and keep raising money as you can until you've given all of your money away for rent, or you've satisfied the amount for rent.
I'd just hide loads of money under the board because I'd always be like, ha ha ha, I have secret money that you didn't know about.
Yep.
We just kept it in like crazy piles that you couldn't see how much was in there like under your lap or something. But yeah.
So what I'm seeing here, and this is great, because as we're talking about this game, Christy mentioned, you know, how we're talking about Dead of Winter and all the different things we did. We're doing the same thing with this game that we keep saying is the worst game ever.
Here's why it's the worst game ever. I don't remember the end of a single game of Monopoly.
That's true.
I don't know that I ever finished a game of Monopoly.
No, I think
they ended in one of three ways. I'm bored. Let's go watch a movie.
Okay.
I'm mad and I flip the board over.
All right.
Somebody else gets mad and they flip the board over. Seriously, this is boring. Or somebody's just like, oh, forget it.
But maybe it's because people didn't play by the proper rules. You said the thing about putting money in. Maybe that's part of the rule and the auctioning thing. Yeah. Maybe that's why they always went on forever, is because no one actually paid attention to the rules.
I've never played with the auction. Mostly because I think when I started playing, I was playing two players. So if you're playing two players, you either buy it or you don't buy it. And you could really game the system if you auction, like, I don't want to buy it, but I'm going to buy it for $10, or I'm going to buy it just for more than you have. And I don't know why I never did it. I just never did. I've never played where free parking didn't give you money.
And no, we didn't do that.
Yeah, we put everything, taxes, anything that you'd pay to the board, we put that on free parking. So you would land there and you'd get like
$2,000. That's weird.
Well, that's because that's how it's supposed to be played.
I think we played almost by the rules, but we didn't auction. I think that's the only rule that we did not follow. Other than that, we were very... My family's a little bit uptight.
Yeah. Well, not oxygen, not auctioning can make the game run a lot longer because you have to land again on that property before anyone has a chance of buying it. So the auction mechanic makes sure that these properties get out into circulation much quicker.
Yeah. It's going to be a lot shorter.
Yeah. So like I say, it's not a terrible game. It's a roll and move. There's a decent amount of luck. It's a lot about negotiation. More though, so than anything else, it's about negotiation.
Fun. Which is fun. Yeah, I think that's the fun part of it, because you're there with your family most times, or friends, whatever, and you're there like, you know, wheeler dealering, like, oh, come on, you know, just I'll give you two.
Which is my least favorite thing about a game.
I liked it.
Well, another benefit about the game, though, is because it's so random, you could have a 6-year-old and, you know, a 60-year-old at the same table, and they have a pretty similar chance of winning. Because I've seen 6-year-olds like, no, I'm not trading anything, ever. Yep. So, oh, you want to try to, you know, get this boardwalk from me? No way. I'm just going to sit on that. You're not, your park place is useless. And they're ruthless.
Yeah. It really evens the playing field. You're right.
Yep. So I think that it is a type of game that can bring the entire family together in rage sometimes.
Still a bonding experience.
But still a bonding experience. Yeah. And we just went to Barnes & Noble today and looking at, I think I saw like 15 different themed Monopolies.
Yeah.
You know, from Star Wars to Game of Thrones to Super Mario Brothers, actually two different Super Mario Brothers ones. You know, there are just tons and tons of themes to it, which is why I think put in the exception is this game exists in so many different iterations. There's the credit card one where you don't have currency anymore. You just have a little thing and you swipe your credit card every time you have to pay somebody. The more I think about it, the more I just want to get put Monopoly on the table and play.
Is it a bit like the Game of Life? Because I have never actually played the Game of Life.
All right.
But is it kind of teaching kids as well about life and about money and about, you know, is that part of Monopoly, do you think? Is that part of the whole point of it? Or
so,
is that kind of very loose?
I think we should segue to the Game of Life. But to answer your question very briefly, Monopoly was created to teach people how capitalism was terrible.
Yeah.
It backfired.
99% Invisible did a great episode on it. I think the title of the episode is The Landlord's Game.
Yep.
Oh,
and
amazing.
I highly recommend listening to that episode.
I do love that podcast.
They do a great job explaining it much better than we could do in our time frame.
Definitely. Yeah.
So, but let's go to the Game of Life. The Game of Life plays like this. You spin the wheel. You move your car X number of spaces that come up on a wheel. So then wheel has numbers, I think 1 through 6 or something along those lines.
Yeah.
You move your car that many spaces and you do what it says.
That's it.
Yeah, it's almost Candyland.
But then, again, I haven't played Candyland. But Gloria, because I was mentioning that we were talking about this, she was gushing about the Game of Life. You know, all these memories that she had. Like, oh, one time I had so many kids, I had all this money, and I also had too many kids for my car, so I was putting these pegs in the side of the car instead of the top. And I was like, I had no idea what she was talking about. But it was all these feelings.
It's a really fun game, but you don't do much.
Right. There's no real decisions.
It's almost more like a choose your own adventure game, but instead of choosing an adventure, you're spinning your own adventure. You just land on the squares.
Yeah, you don't really choose. There's actually one decision point in the game. You can go left or right. There's a fork in the road. You can choose left or right.
Okay.
But again, I think it goes back to the same thing. I think this episode is turning into how I actually really like these mainstream games, because life, what happened is, again, you have this family around the table. Everybody can play. There is, like, you know, the 6-year-old spins the wheel. The 6-year-old spins the wheel. You move. You do what it says. Things happen to you. And you just remember those things. It's like, oh, I got married. Now I put a pink peg in the car. You know, and then the cars are made with, like, six little peg slots. And you put a colored peg, blue or pink, in the driver's seat. And as you go through, you may get, you know, you'll get married. Gives you another peg. You'll have kids, which will give you pegs, and they'll be different genders. So you have blue pegs and pink pegs. And it was easy. And whoever got to the end first won, which I think is, you drove off a cliff. Funeral home? I don't know.
I don't remember how it ends. Once again, that's the thing. And I will bring up my favorite mainstream game, which I think is the exception to a lot of these things we've been talking about, and that is Clue.
Okay. Yes. I would actually want to shout out David Radke, now that we know how to say your name. His favorite game is Clue.
It's a fun game. There's actual strategy to it. You have things that you can do to give you an edge over other players. There's tricky bits you can do. You can choose what rooms to go to. What you do feels like it matters to your winning the game. You can be better at Clue than someone else.
Yes.
Yes, there is randomness to it. Yes, sometimes you just get lucky. But you can, there are strategies. There are things we always used to, like, because you, the way Clue works is there's a deck of cards, there's people, weapons, and locations. You remove a person, you remove a weapon, you remove a location, put them in a secret envelope, and the goal of the game is to find out what's in that envelope by process of elimination. So you go to the rooms and you question people. So you'd go to the rooms that you have in your hand, or you'd ask the people
you have. So you shuffle all of the remaining clues that don't go in the envelope. Yes. You shuffle those together.
And then they go to the players.
They go, all those go to the players until all the clues are gone.
So you know what you have in your hand, and you can go to locations and ask a question where other players need to show you a card from their hand to prove that that person is innocent, or that weapon was not used, or it did not happen in that location. Oh, yeah,
it was like Colonel Mustard in the library with the wrench, and then someone goes, no, I've got the wrench, so it couldn't have been that.
Correct.
But you only show it to the person asking the question.
And they don't know what card they showed you of the three that you asked.
Right.
So they just know that one of those three. So we'd ask questions that had only one card that we didn't know already, so that you could make you were like fishing for specific information.
Oh, that's a smart move, yeah.
Or you ask for something that is in your hand. I have Colonel Mustard and the wrench in the library in my hand. But I'm going to say, Colonel Mustard with the wrench in the library, and nobody's going to show me anything.
And then everyone else will go, oh, is that right? Or is he asking two that he has, and one of those is correct? You can really mess with people psychologically. There's a lot to play with.
I remember David was mentioning how his daughter had completely fooled him the whole game, kept saying the same person over and over again. I mean, that's, you know, it's impressive. Like, I guess kids can learn a lot of good things from games like this.
The only downside, we talk about modern mechanics, and there are, like, modern games play differently than the older games. The most common mechanic in older games was roll and move. So you have a piece, you roll a die, and you move that many spaces.
Shoots and ladders and whatever. Yeah. Yeah.
For whatever reason, Clue also has a roll and move mechanic to it. The rooms are a single space, but the hallways are squares. And you roll a single six-sided die to try to get from one room to the other.
Oh.
And until you get to a room, you can't make an accusation.
Oh, I'd forgotten that part of it.
Right. Yeah. So you could roll
once. You just get stuck in the hallway, and it's so frustrating.
Yep. But if you were to remove that, if you just said everyone moves four spaces every turn, you know, or just say moving into the hallway is a single space and you can move into another room, you take away that randomness. I'm not suggesting that you do. There is some kind of nostalgicness to rolling that die.
I wonder how it would play, though. I kind of want to try it.
I think there, a lot of people do play it that way.
Really?
Where you'll section off where it's like, okay, to get from one room to another, it's you count spaces and you get a certain number of spaces or something
like
that.
Well, again, I guess family games are more geared towards having some element of random just put in there so it helps out the people.
It normalizes, you know, children, the skill.
Basically, yep. Yeah.
I like, there are other ways to do that, though, without randomness, where my family did this a lot. But we can talk about it on a different episode because it's a card game. So we'll bring this up for card games in a lot of depth because it's my favorite card game. But
yeah, well, I will say I think Clue is one of those games that really inspired a whole lot of figuring it out games.
Yes.
And I will still play Clue to this day. Now, I don't normally play it because there's so many other options. But if someone wants to play Clue, sure, let's do it.
There's also a really great Harry Potter themed Clue.
Yes.
That is a really fun game that adds some really fun Harry Potter specific elements that work really well with the theme of Clue. And it's really fun.
Do we know what the name is for that one?
I think it's Harry Potter Clue.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah. So let's jump to Risk real quick. We've talked about Risk a number of times. Josh and Kitty have both talked about how they've played it as a kid forever. Risk is kind of the initial area control mainstream game. Now, there were other games around at that time. I don't know if Risk was the first. I can't think it was, but it definitely caught on to the point where people would play this like a ton.
I think it might have been the first.
It might have been. Axis and Allies was a big one too back then, which was a little bit more realistic area control, but
it also had a lot more kind of barrier to entry, kind of rule learning, and probably a game now that seems real easy to learn compared to some of these other big games. Yeah. But
so the way Risk worked is you had these little plastic pieces that were Roman numerals, ones, fives, and tens, which stood for the number of army units you had in different regions of the world. This was back in my day.
Yeah,
this
I was going to say, I'd never heard of that either.
Yep. This is, well, if you look, you'll find these pieces all over the place. Now, I actually think they actually have little army men.
Yeah,
shaped
they have
pieces.
Little like riflemen and a horse and then a cannon.
Right. So those are your ones, fives, and tens.
Although honestly, we had an even older version where they were just like wooden. It was like a wooden block was one, and then there was like a star shaped piece was five, and then there was like a cylinder that was ten.
So you have these symbols that represent numbers of armies, and you want to go and attack. And the whole rule for attacking was you can move as many of your armies forward as you want into a particular territory, and the defenders would roll dice based on the number of defenders, and the attacker would roll dice based on the number of attackers. So if I moved five armies into Kitty's territory and she had one defender there, she would roll one die for her defender, and I would not roll five dice for my attacker because there's a maximum of three dice I could roll.
Yes.
So I would roll my three dice, she would roll her one die. We would compare the biggest, the highest numbers. If her higher number was bigger than my higher number, I lost a unit, and she had no more defending pieces, so those other two dice didn't matter. So she didn't actually lose a unit. So a defender with a single one, if you just kept rolling sixes and the other person on their three dice couldn't roll above six.
You can't because ties go to defender.
Right.
So sixes are an auto win for defenders. But yep. Even if you're rolling fives, fours or fives can take out an army.
Yep. I've seen cases where like one or two units defended against an army of 10.
It feels amazing when you're
for the defender.
And the attacker is just like, ah!
So if you do, and the defender has a maximum number of two dice that they can roll.
Yes.
So no matter how many units are attacking, the defender will only ever roll up to two, and the attacker will only roll up to three. But you keep rolling until the combat's over. If you take over the territory, i.e. all the defenders are dead, you move all your units in, and then you can move them again, and you can keep taking over. Well, what happens is this thins your armies out. So now you have one or two people left in all these different territories, and then someone else can come in and wipe out all of those things. So it's a lot of back and forth and back and forth and back
and forth. Was this another game?
If you play that way.
Yeah.
I played with a lot of people because it was like a group of guys that we all used to play when we were younger. And like, this is another game where we never finished. Like, we really, like, we'd play for hours at night. And then, I mean, it was so much fun. We were always playing the Lord of the Rings version because it had just come out around that time. And we were like, oh, into Lord of the Rings. But you just stay up until like 4 a.m. and be like, oh, whatever, we'll play some other time. We'll keep it out. And then we never did.
Yeah.
But was that the same with you, Kitty? Did you feel like it just went on and never finished?
We always finish.
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
So at a certain point, I think the 10th time, so you there's the other these cards that you draw. I believe whenever you took a territory, would draw a card.
At the end of your turn, if you took a territory, you get a card.
Yeah. And if you have three of a kind or three different, so I think there was three actual different types. There was
yes.
cannons and riflemen and something else.
Infantry. Cavalry. And cannons.
Yeah. And if you have one of each of them, you could turn it in and you get a number of armies at the beginning of your turn. Well, the first time you turn them in, you get like three armies, then five armies, then seven armies. The 10th time you turn it in, you got like 30 armies. And
you're just throwing pieces on the board like, ha, 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 like a madman. Oh,
wow. So, but you could save them. So other people might, you know, oh, you're going to use it first. So you're going to get the three armies. I'm holding mine back. At a certain point, you had to use them. I think if you had more than five cards.
Yeah.
You had to use it. But you'd save it. And if you were the person that hit like ninth or 10th spot where you're getting like 25 armies or 30 armies, that's when you do the push to destroy the board and try to win before someone else can also turn in their three cards, get 30 armies, and do the same thing to you.
Wow.
It's really fun. It's making me want to play. It's a really fun game to play the computer version or online, because the biggest problem with it is waiting for somebody else to take their turn if you're not involved in the combat. All the fiddly bits. There's tons and tons of little troops moving all over the board. And it really matters what country they're sitting in. If they accidentally get bumped like a millimeter to the left, suddenly your game is completely different. You could have ruined everything. And it's just really tough to be sitting there waiting that whole time, playing it straight through. Yeah. Playing online is really great because you can take your turn, leave, and then come back when it's your turn again. It's fun.
Yeah. That's cool. Yeah, and I feel like the kids that, you know, pick up this game, you sort of learn to... This is a quite a competitive game, so I feel like it teaches those skills to, like, be a good or bad winner or loser. Whether or not that can be taught or not, I don't know. Yeah. I'm still kind of a bad loser to this day.
Well, Risk is one of those games, though. So Monopoly, the rules really haven't changed much at all over time.
Yeah.
Clue, the rules really haven't changed at all over time. Like, variants aside, Risk, the rules have been streamlined over time, just ever so slightly. The number of armies you get, the card distributions and things like that. I think that if you get a base copy of Risk now, it also comes with three different modes to win.
Yeah.
So you can win with victory points versus like having to take over the entire world and things like that. So the rules have been updated to kind of fix the runaway, this game's going to take forever to play type of thing.
Right.
But you can still play it the standard way as well. And it plays... All right. Like, if you're comparing it to other modern territory control, maybe it's not the most elegant, but I agree. It can still be fun.
It's real. I really like it. The problem is the time, but also the elimination. Once you're out of the game, you're out of the game. There's, you know, you're off on your own. Oh, well.
I think that that's a really good point in mainstream games, is player elimination existed almost in every one of them. So Monopoly had elimination. Clue did not.
Clue did not. Yep. That's why Clue's the best.
Yep.
But
Risk had elimination. I guess Life didn't.
I don't know. I always felt like Life was seriously just, oh, look, this is a thing. I don't know.
Yeah,
it wasn't my favorite. It's fun.
I really,
once or twice.
I really enjoyed it, but it was mostly because of the three-dimensional board. I did not realize I wasn't playing a game when I was playing Life.
I think I was too old for Life when I came to it.
Maybe, yeah. I guess when I say elimination, really it's just Monopoly and Risk of the games we're talking about so far. We're going to mention Scrabble, but just briefly, because Scrabble is still a very popular game today and people play it all over.
And we talked about it a lot in our Word Games episode.
Yeah, so we're just mentioning it. Trivial Pursuit seems to almost not exist anymore.
I loved it, though.
Yeah,
we used to play it all the time. I think it's been eliminated because of the internet.
Maybe.
Because people can look it up online.
You can look up the answer so easy.
Well, you
can
just flip the you flip the cards over and cheat.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe it's... And also, like, the information gets outdated so much faster.
That's true. That was hard as well. I found as a kid, we were playing some old copy of it, and it was like... You know, rockers from the 60s, like, questions about their lives, and I'm like, I don't know.
You need
Trivial Pursuit is based, and there's still copies of it. You can still find it on the short shelves. I saw it at
Store shelves.
Yep, at Barnes and Noble. However, Trivial Pursuit is it's on the top list of the worst games ever designed, and I'll tell you why. Your trivia things, right? But roll and move to try to get on a color that happens to match something you're looking for, and then hopefully that particular question, sports, is something that you could possibly guess an answer to, but no, because it's not multiple choice. You just have to pull an answer randomly out of nowhere.
That's true. It's difficult.
So tedious.
We solved this in my family was we always played it on teams. It's much more fun when you get to confer as a team.
Yeah, it's basically like trivia night.
It is like trivia night at the bar. It's way more fun. It goes faster. There's more chances of somebody knowing the answer. We always played boys versus girls. And then you're like, and I like the strategy because every time you roll the dice, it's not just one square you can move to. It's three, usually. Sometimes only two. Occasionally three. And you can choose, like, all right, we're trying to get this pie piece, so we're going to move we're not going down the orange one because everyone hates orange. Let's go answer the pink question so we can try to get the blue pie.
All right. The other problem, though, is if you get the question right, you get to take another turn.
Yeah.
So someone else who's good at questions, they're just answering green questions over and over and over because that's what they keep landing on. And I'm just sitting there watching them being like, well, when I take my turn, I'm going to get a question wrong immediately and have no.
Well, you can house rule that pretty quickly. But I get what you're saying. If that's an actual rule,
we've
that's
got the
lame.
Person. We always do it so like the one person asks the question from the other team and then the other team all passes the card around and like snickers at you and tries not to give the answer away. Oh, I don't know. Yeah. My family likes this game a lot. You don't like trivia that much.
It's true. I don't like trivia, but I think there are trivia games that I will play. I just think this game is very bad mechanically.
Sure. Fair I agree enough. With that. Yeah.
That's my big problem with it is the mechanically is just so frustrating to like, oh man, I got the first five pieces and I just need the sixth piece. And I'm going to not roll the right die like over and over and over as everyone else is just passing me by.
I don't know a lot of other general knowledge trivia games.
I like You Don't Know Jack.
Yeah, that was good.
That one was fun.
That was good.
Although I think that was a video game.
That's
I don't
a video
know.
Game. Yeah, a video yeah game.
But it was a trivia
game. Like
video
a board game,
game
though.
Honestly,
and video games have kind of replaced trivia board games.
Yeah. What's the one?
Because they can be updated.
Wits and Wagers. I like that one. And the reason I like that one is because everybody has a valid guess.
Don't have to be right.
And you don't have to be right. You just have to be close.
I don't like that. You have to be right. That's the whole point of trivia is knowing the answer.
All right. Well, let's talk about Yahtzee.
Yahtzee. It's a fun game.
Yes. I agree. I remember playing Yahtzee over and over and over and over.
Same.
With my mom. Again, as another game as a kid, it the dice equalize the skill level.
Yeah.
Like if I roll a Yahtzee, it doesn't matter. It's like, oh, you roll five dice and you're attempting to get the most ones, twos, threes, fours, or fives. Those are your number scoring. Or you're trying to get straights. I think triples and
three of a kind or four of a kind.
Three of a kind, four of a kind. And Yahtzee is five of a kind.
Yes.
And I want to say there was a couple of full house was one, you could, a two and a three, two of a kind plus three of a kind. So, and you had a score pad and you would play until you no longer could score anywhere on the score pad. If you rolled something and it couldn't score, you could cross something off so you get 0 points for it. So there was some strategy in where you would score your dice. So if I got four ones, if I scored in the one column, that's just 4 points. But if I scored in the four of a kind column, it's like 40 points or something like that. I'm
not sure that's right.
I'm not sure that's right, but you would get more points scoring it as a four of a kind versus ones. However, sixes, you'd probably get one a scored in the sixes area because you'd get, you know, 24 points. Where if you scored as four of a kind, maybe you only got 20 points, or you might even get 30 points, but they're still sixes. So you want to use them more sixes there. So you had some strategy in where you would place those dice, but ultimately it's just, do I get lucky and roll what I want?
Well, you also get to choose what you keep. You don't just roll the dice one time, you roll and you choose the dice from the pool that you're keeping, and then you re-roll the rest. Yeah. So if you're looking at what you still need and trying to strategize about what you're trying to roll, there is a little bit there too.
Yeah, which is we refer to as the Yahtzee mechanic, which is roll the dice, keep what you want, re-roll, and Yahtzee has two re-rolls.
Yes.
You could re-roll dice you kept. So if I kept, you know, I rolled, you know, two sixes, I kept those two sixes and I re-rolled everything else, and now I get three fives, I could say, oh, I'm going to keep the fives and re-roll the sixes because I want to try to get another five. So that mechanic has been used in tons and tons of games since then. Like, that's Yahtzee's greatest contribution to the gaming industry. Probably of the mainstream games we're talking about, probably the biggest contribution.
Yeah.
Just of the ones we've mentioned. Clue's still up there.
Yeah. There are a lot of Clue-like games out there, which are really fun.
Yeah. But that Yahtzee reroll mechanic, it's used everywhere. Thanks to Yahtzee. And Role Player is not like Yahtzee.
Yahtzee is a great game to play with kids because it's really easy to lay out their choices for them, but let them make, like, still feel like they're playing the game for themselves.
Yeah. So we're going really long. But here's the initial question that I was asking is, do these games hide the depth of the hobby? Do having these mainstream games, are they taking people who are not really like hobby board games, they're not walking into game stores, is it making them think that board games are just random events that you sit around the table and whoever you know, rolls the right dice or lands in the right properties or makes the right guess of what's in the, you know, hidden card sleeve, is this what people are thinking board games are?
Well, I mean, I think back in the day, yes. And I think it's still true that some people do think that. But these days, more people are aware of things like Catan and Ticket to Ride. Like, you know, I've mentioned now that I've been getting into the hobby more, Ticket to the Ride, Catan, to people. And I've rarely had anyone go, oh, never heard of those. So, yeah. I mean, the fact is there are other mainstream games that are kind of falling into this category now where everyone's heard of them and most people like have a copy or whatever. So I would say, you know, they're great intros, and yes, some people will think, you know, that's, you know, just all the hobby is, but to be honest, these days I don't think as much.
Yeah.
What do you think, Chris?
I have to agree with Josh that I think there are a lot of mainstream games, and especially the like kids who are growing up now, because, you know, the board game hobby kind of had a resurgence about 10, 15 years ago. So, you know, we're looking at teenagers now who have always had these like more hobbyist games available to them. So they are seeing different things out there. They're going to their friend's house and they're not seeing Monopoly on the shelf. They're seeing Catan or Ticket to Ride. And I think that that's changing. And I honestly think that this is just like anything where the younger generations grow up with something new and it becomes the norm. Most of the people in your, you know, late 20s and on, the games we just talked about, you played as a kid. And today, the games that you play as a kid, I don't know that you're doing that. I don't know anyone in my generation that's teaching their kids Monopoly right now.
Right.
And I think that that is what's going to change the hobby more than anything. And I think that's why the hobby will continue to grow and become more diverse. And board games aren't going to be these mainstream games that we think about, the ones where you could name 10 of them and everyone knows. It's going to be a lot more like video games where everyone just knows, oh, there are a ton of video games and there's all kinds of them. And I like these kind of video games or that kind of video games. You don't have as many people just saying, I don't like video games.
Yeah.
You have people that are like, I like Candy Crush. I don't like first-person shooters.
Oh, video games? You mean Mario?
Yeah, exactly.
I was going to say, it's the same thing, though, where there is always going to be the classics.
Yep.
And I think that that's not going to change. But I do think that more and more of those classics are going to draw people deeper in. I think that there's enough people out there who are like, oh, you like to play Clue? Let's try playing, what was the time game that we played?
Stories, but you really want to play Time Stories.
I want to play Time Stories. No, the other one, Professor Evil.
In the Citadel of Time?
In the Citadel of Time, yes. That, like, if you like Clue, you will like Professor Evil in the Citadel of Time. It feels very, like, it's not the same, but you're still, like, moving around. It's secret. It's doing stuff like that.
The board looks very similar.
It does look similar.
But it's a completely different game, but a great segue from Clue.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, well, let's play this cooperative game that feels that same way.
Let me draw you in further into my web until you'll play Time Stories with me, because I really want to play Time Stories.
All right. We'll play Time Stories soon. I do have to say, though, I hope the listeners got the feel, too. I did not expect to be reminiscing about these games as positively as we ended up doing it. Because, like, even so, yeah, I agree. Most of these games, they didn't end. But the visceral memories of playing them are good memories. Like,
yeah,
I don't know. Maybe there is something to just gaming in general. It doesn't matter what game you're playing. As long as you're playing with people and people you enjoy playing with or getting angry with or flipping the table over, like, that's what brings people together. And that's really what the hobby has to help, like, in general, is just bringing people together. Family game nights, do it. Do it with something not Monopoly, but play Monopoly with your kids once or twice so they know. So they also know what the game is. Try it by the rules. Maybe it'll be a new game to you, too. All right. So should we call it?
Yeah.
I think so.
All right, Josh.
All right. Well, thanks for listening. And remember, we love your feedback. So consider leaving us an iTunes review or email us with comments and questions at tabletopgametalk@gmail.com. Finally, a huge thank you to our patrons, Emil Jiljam, George, Adam Harrison, Sam from New York, Jason Strong, Terence Miltner, Stephen Seitz, Alex Brown, Michael Ohl, Josh Arntz, Trevor Olson, Brian Arnold, Sean P. Kelly, John Merkel, Daniel Shepard, C. Marie, Rudy Rudy Lou, Benjamin Heimowitz, Jerry Huang, Mike Smith, Stefan Phillips, Caleb O'Brien, John Lewis, Jennifer Engelbrecht, Justin Willard, Christopher Dong, Jason Marks, Jeremy Fisher, Kyle Hammond, David Radke, Lance Morgan, and Nick Quickstra. Please tell me if that's wrong, Nick. Until next week, when we talk about managing fiddly bits, keep playing games and having fun.
Good night. So, Josh, you've not played Clue?
It was so long ago, I've forgotten it all.
Kitty, do you have a copy of Clue?
Of course I do.
I don't have any of these games we just talked about.
What?
Let's play Clue!
All right, let's go play Clue.